Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Magochi, who is the Chair of Ukrainian Studies and Professor of History and Political Science at the University of Toronto. He has published 30 books, including A History of Ukraine, The Land and Its People, The Roots of Ukrainian Nationalism, and Ukraine, an Illustrated History. His research interest focuses on nationalism, in particular among ethnic groups living in border areas, and he's the author of the forthcoming book, Crimea and the Crimean Tatars. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Magochi.
Thank you.
And quite a lot to talk about here today. And I must say the tone that's coming out of Moscow now from the foreign ministry is quite alarming. The foreign ministries have suggested that Ukraine's new pro-Western government in Kiev are not protecting pro-Russian citizens in eastern Ukraine and that they're sowing chaos. And, of course, this is something of a repeat or an echo of justifications that Russia made to intervene in Crimea with the pretext that they had to protect Crimeans from abuse, etc. Just to quote the foreign ministry statement, Russia is outraged by the chaos which is currently ruling in eastern regions of Ukraine as a result of the actions of militants of the so-called right sector amid utter connivance of the new authorities, as they call themselves. So do you think that Putin and Russian propaganda are preparing the Russian people for another military invasion, this time of eastern Ukraine?
The simple answer to that question is yes.
So if that happens, how could you control that? So far, nobody's been killed in Crimea. There have been a few shots fired. But my understanding is if Putin were to do that, then you would have an all-out war.
It is quite possible that should Russia decide to make that move based on whatever flimsy justification they use, that's a different question. But if they would take that move of invading, assuming that they are coming to assuage the suffering Russian-speaking population of eastern Ukraine, yes, I can imagine very well that Ukrainians would respond militarily, both in terms of the organized armed forces of the state and even more likely the kind of unorganized partisan elements within society. This would be considered a complete violation of not only their sovereignty, but their nationality and their nation state.
So how much are the Russians playing games here rhetorically, or are they? I mean, do you think that Putin actually believes all this stuff, the kind of stuff that he said in his first press conference where he described Kiev as being a bunch of right-wing fanatics in Kiev wearing armbands and swastika-like symbols, like a jack-in-the-box, some nationalist type of or semi-fascist element, some kind of anti-Semite could pop out? What's he talking about there? Because the current prime minister in this new government in Kiev is Jewish, and apparently he's had very cordial relations with Putin up until now.
Well, I think there are two things that need to be said in terms of the question that you've raised. The first thing is the most important, I would suggest, and that is what Putin is doing is not at all a surprise. It is in complete keeping with long-term historical Russian policy, and there's no reason why any of us should somehow be surprised that this is something new that he's doing. And what do I have in mind? What I have in mind is the following, that at least since the 14th century, there has been ideological preparation, first during the Muscovite state, and then its successor, the Russian Empire, then the Soviet Union, and now the Russian Federation, all of whom claim direct lineage one from the other. And the position going back to the 14th century and continuing up to the present with Putin is that all of the East Slavic peoples, what we understand today as ethnic Russians, Belarusians, and ethnic Ukrainians, are one Orthodox Rus people, culture, and civilization. That the most natural thing in the world is for them to live preferably under one political system, or if not ideally in a political sphere in which they are closely interrelated. This has been Muscovite, Imperial Russian, and Soviet policy, and now the policy of Putin for 6, 7 centuries. In that context, when during the 19th century, some of these peoples, in particular the Belarusians, but more so Ukrainians, began to argue that, wait a minute, we are not ethnic Russians. We are a different people with a different language and a different culture, and we have a right to our own self-rule. The Russian response immediately and continuing to the present, with the exception, a little bit I might add, of the Soviet period, is that there's no such thing as a Ukrainian people or a Belarusian people or a Ukrainian language or a Belarusian. These are just dialects of Russian. We are the same people. We come from the same Orthodox world. And therefore, to have an independent state, what for? This, from the standpoint of Vladimir Putin, is something in total violation of the Russian historical tradition. So that is one aspect, that is the cultural aspect, deeply embedded and ingrained in what we could say are the Russian cultural genes. They simply cannot abide by the fact that Ukraine exists in any form as a something separate from Russia. The second thing is, of course, the geographic and political strategic location of Ukraine. That is, it is its territory faces the Black Sea, warm waters all year long, something that Russia doesn't have and has always wanted. And this has been part of Russian Muscovite and then Russian foreign policy going back at least to Peter the First, as in Russian terms called Peter the Great. That is, access to the Black Sea, to warm water ports, and hence to the Mediterranean. The primary geopolitical goal of Muscovy and then the Russian Empire and then the Soviet Union to hold on to it. And in this context, it makes Crimea and other ports like Odessa in southern Ukraine now of exceeding strategic importance, combined with what I said before of the deep-seated cultural attitude of Russia toward Ukraine. So it's in this context that everything that we see now and is going on in the last week and any statements by Putin, this is all detail. This is all simply an excuse or looking for an excuse to achieve these overall century-long goals.
Well, but this may be what Putin feels and what Russian leaders have practiced over the centuries. But the latest polls in Russia indicate that the Russian people feel strong fraternal and cultural ties and familial ties with Ukraine and are not happy about the possibility of any armed conflict.
Well, you've just actually confirmed in another way what I've just said. What I was describing about Putin was not just simply him. He is reflective of deep-seated attitudes within the Russian people as a whole, within Russian culture as a whole. And absolutely, in this context, the vast majority of people in Russia support this position that is now being carried out by Putin. Absolutely.
Well, is that to say they would support an armed invasion of Ukraine?
Absolutely.
And what if it turns out the way that it surely will, into a hideous fratricidal battle?
If that were to occur, it would be terrible, but the fault would be on those people in Ukraine in power right now from, as they describe, extreme Ukrainian nationalists, anti-Semites, pseudo-fascists, illegal government, and so forth and so on, which with all of the phrases that are used to denigrate your enemy because you do not agree with your enemy, whether on geographic and strategic grounds or on cultural grounds.
Again, let me remind the audience, if I may, that I'm speaking with Paul Magochi, who is the chair of Ukrainian studies and a professor of history and political science at the University of Toronto. He's published 30 books, including A History of Ukraine, The Land and Its People, The Roots of Ukrainian Nationalism, and Ukraine, an Illustrated History. His research interests focus on nationalism, in particular among ethnic groups living in border areas, and he's the author of the forthcoming book, Crimea and the Crimean Tatars. Now, when you go back over the centuries, as you've done, my sense is, though, that it's the more recent history that in many ways reminds me of the Balkans, where where history becomes buried. It's sort of put into a deep freeze under the guise of Soviet fraternalism, and that the memories in Ukraine of Stalin's forced collectivization that killed up to 8 million Ukrainians between 1932 and 1933 are probably more fresher in the consciousness, or in the subconscious, if you will. And also on the Russian side, of course, they remember the ultra-nationalist leader Stepan Bandera and the extent to which Ukrainians collaborated with Hitler in killing Poles and Jews. So is that not a more recent part of the problem?
Present-day Ukrainians, of course, what I was speaking about until now was the thought processes of Putin.
Sure.
And how he reflects Russian culture and Russian attitudes toward the problem. I wasn't speaking about at all until now the Ukrainian perception of the problem. Without question, the Ukrainian perception of the problem is diametrically opposed, beginning with the fact that most Ukrainians, and I also hasten to add that there are many Ukrainians who are Russian speakers. Just being a Russian speaker does not make you a non-Ukrainian or does not make you a Russian. Ukrainians can be, ethnic Ukrainians can be Ukrainian speakers or they can be Russian speakers. And yet both of them can feel themselves equally to be part of the Ukrainian nationality and the Ukrainian nation state. From the standpoint of ethnic Ukrainians and all those who consider themselves part of the Ukrainian nation state, they obviously have a tradition in which, at least going back to the 19th century, that they have a right to their own culture, their own language, etc., and that they have been treated badly, to say the least, both by the Russian Empire and most particularly by the Soviet Union, which, as you've correctly alluded to, in the 1930s, this incredibly dastardly act of death by famine, Holodomor, it's known in Ukrainian, which was, to many people's specialists' views, an artificial famine. And even if one doesn't want to think that it's genocide, clearly 4 to 8 million people died in Ukraine. Not all ethnic Ukrainians, but the vast majority of them were ethnic Ukrainians. And this is deeply embedded as part of the Soviet heritage, which is now trying to be revivified by the present leadership in Moscow, specifically under Putin. And it's therefore not surprising that they are totally opposed to this.
So what then can be done, just to get back to the urgency of the day, because we've agreed that some of the rhetoric coming out of Moscow is quite ominous, and it is reminiscent of laying the groundwork for what happened in Crimea, and in the situation in Crimea is anything but stable. The Tatars are not happy about it, and the Ukrainian minority are getting beaten up by Russian thugs for trying to protest this referendum that Putin is forcing down their throats as quickly as he can. So there's a real danger here that things could spin out of control. What can the Ukrainians do to satisfy this or to neutralize Russian propaganda about the notion that these people that have taken over in Kiev are a bunch of Nazis? I mean, you do have people in the government, the Deputy Secretary of National Security, Yarosh is a leader of the right sector. John McCain, when he visited the Maidan, he shared the stage with Svoboda's anti-Semitic leader, Oleg Tyrbok, if that's the correct pronunciation.
Tyrbok.
Yeah. So tell me, what can be done to dispel these ideas that have, become Russian propaganda, and they've been picked up to some extent by the European left and by the American left?
Well, first of all, again, I'll return that because you've asked what Ukrainians can do to dispel the second part of your question.
Well, that's assuming that I'm correct in believing that this is exaggerated.
Of course, but you still have two questions here. You have the questions are, is what can Ukrainians do with regard to this threat from Russia on the one hand, that first is clear in Crimea and then will be clear, and then seems to be now clear in eastern Ukraine. That's one question. And then the other question is what can the present Ukrainian government do to dispel these attacks or claims by Russia that they are somehow a fascist or anti-Semitic or so forth and so on. So these are two separate questions. The first question is what can Ukrainians do with regard to Russian military threat, et cetera? I've said already, the only thing they can do is stand up and fight if that is going to lead that, because Vladimir Putin is not giving up Crimea. He has taken this territory illegally from Ukraine. He is not giving it up. And if anyone thinks that that's going to happen, they have no understanding of this long-term historical view of Russia toward this part of the world. Similarly, not only is he not ever going to give up Crimea, but he will most preferably want all of Ukraine, and certainly not to divide Ukraine. Why? Because all of Ukraine is part of this larger world of Rus, of historic, holy, Orthodox Russia, which he represents. So in this particular equation, what can Ukrainians do? I mean, they can't actually do anything other than stand up for what they have. And if it takes military action to do so, then that's their only choice. Because Putin is not going to change. He can't change. It's in his genes. He's just a representative, as I said and I've repeated, of this long historical tradition. That's one thing. The other side of your question, and that is, what can the Ukrainian government do to counteract these attacks on it and denigration directed toward the present government from effectively an outside, in this case, enemy power? Well, I mean, that's sort of like saying what any other dictator who had wanted to take over another country and spreads false rumors against that country and false rumors and false statements, what can you do other than try to explain to the rest of the world that these kinds of attacks and these kinds of assumptions are totally untrue? Of course, the best way to do that is not by just countering with words, but rather with actions. First and foremost, the Maidan that began, or the protests on the Maidan, that began back in November and lasted well into January on the Maidan, more than one night, more than one day, were Jews living in Ukraine supporting the action on Maidan, Crimean Tatars living in Ukraine supporting the actions on Maidan. The first death, by the way, of anyone on the Maidan happened to be a Ukrainian of Armenian background. This is not ethnic Ukrainians versus Russia. This is the state of Ukraine and all the citizens of that country, regardless of their national background, who feel that their country, regardless of whether they are Jewish, Polish, ethnic Ukrainian, Armenian, etc., is being threatened. First threatened from within by their own government, which they wanted to get rid of, and they did, and now threatened by the outside. So the actions speak much louder than words. You've already said quite correctly that the prime minister of this new government, which is allegedly anti-Semitic, is Jewish, and openly Jewish. How anti-Semitic can it be? The governor of Donetsk, in eastern Ukraine, of the new government, is Jewish. The same thing for the governor of Odessa, representing the new government, is Jewish. So, obviously, all of this is just an effort on the part of Putin and the Russian government to undermine, in whatever way possible, from their perspective, its enemy, and that is the present Ukrainian government that doesn't want to be part of Russia. It's purely and simple.
Well, Paul Mugosi, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Mugosi, who is the chair of Ukrainian studies and professor of history and political science at the University of Toronto. He has published 30 books, including A History of Ukraine, The Land and Its Peoples, The Roots of Ukrainian Nationalism, and Ukraine, an Illustrated History. His research interests focus on nationalism, in particular among ethnic groups living in border areas. And he's the author of the forthcoming book, Crimea and the Crimean Tatars. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about Obama suffering in the midterm elections.